there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your secret society of music news and cultural entertainment. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. You're listening to Abakwa Obatala from The Sign and the Seal, Transmissions of the Metaphysics of a Culture by Steve Coleman from 1996. Subject of this podcast is Steve Coleman, who last week became a MacArthur Fellow, which is to say the recipient of the so-called Genius Grant. And we've got Nate Chenin, jazz critic from The Times, on the phone with us. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Ben.
So, Nate, Steve Coleman, we might say, deserved this, by at least by the logic of MacArthur Awards given to improvisers in the recent past. Do you think
there
that's
was a
right?
There was a certain amount of foreshadowing here.
Right. Okay. Why don't you line that out for us?
Well, within the last, decade, there have been, a handful of MacArthur fellowships handed out to jazz musicians, and almost all of them have been to musicians who consider Steve Coleman a great influence and in some ways a mentor.
Right. So we're talking about going back to 2008, and there was a string of them, not in perfectly sequential years, but there was Miguel Zenon, there was Jason Moran, there was Daphnis Prieto, and there was
Vijay Iyer.
Vijay Iyer.
Yeah, so that's what, four?
That's four.
The interesting thing is that those four musicians, I don't think that you'd mistake any one of them for another. Their outputs are pretty distinct.
Right.
And yet, there is a pretty strong line that you can draw from each of those artists to Steve Coleman. And so, what that says about him and his living legacy is interesting.
The music of some of those people might remind you of Steve Coleman's music more than others.
Right.
Right? So Steve Coleman's music tends to be precise, sort of like the rhythm comes first. It's polyrhythmic. It's polyrhythmic, and yet if you really, really do the hard work and try to count it, it often comes down to odd numbers.
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's speaking superficially about how it sounds. It's very chiseled. It's absolutely a system. It's quite intellectual, though it can be incredibly intense. I guess some people who think a certain kind of way about jazz might find it intellectual or even, over-intellectual.
Cerebral. At the same time, there's such a visceral impact to what he does. And this partly has to do with the fact that he, uses a lot of funk rhythm, uses a lot of really earthy and groove-oriented elements in his music, you know, melding it with this kind of improvisational language that, you know, I don't think anyone could argue with the assertion that Steve Coleman is a sort of disciple of Charlie Parker in terms of, you know, his conception of line and, you know, the way that he builds his solos. But it's brought into this, you know, ultra modern, heady and really pretty conceptual mind space.
Right. Now let's pick one of those people, the four people who won MacArthur since 2008, Jason Moran, who did in fact briefly pass through Steve Coleman's band. What do they have in common?
I think that there's a sense of the idea really sort of animating the music that the two of them share. Jason, it comes at it from a different angle, but this was really interesting. A few years ago, I interviewed Ambrose Akinmusiri, the trumpet player who mm-hmm. was coming out at that time with his first album on Blue Note. And, you know, he hasn't won a MacArthur, but he's another young musician who was mentored early on by Steve Coleman.
Yep.
And he told me something that I've since corroborated with other people. He was, you know, I think 19 or 20 or something when he started playing with Coleman. And they were on tour. And, you know, one day early in the tour, they were on a train or backstage or someplace. And Steve Coleman, you know, just sort of starting to get to know him, said, "Okay, so what's your concept?"
Right.
Ambrose said, you know, it sort of knocked him back because, you know, he's just starting to get his act together as a musician. You know, he's still trying to sort of absorb the language and figure out how this all works. And so to be presented with that question, so, you know, at such a formative stage, just that gesture was really influential. And I'm pretty sure that Jason has said that he had the same experience. You know, it's just to be confronted with such a sort of heavy question so right. early, I think is in itself, for the right kind of musician, that's a really influential thing.
Right. You know, one thing Steve Coleman has, and I think all these other people have too, to some degree, is they have sort of a concept, but maybe even a system. It's like they're building outward. They're making connections. They're making a web, you know? And with Steve Coleman, through all these recordings since the mid-80s and through the way he builds his network wider and wider, you can see that web taking shape. Now, that's kind of there's a couple of ways to look at it. One is it's intellectual, you know. If you read some of his writings, for example, go into mystical and esoteric concepts, they go into ideas about, you know, biology and physics and you know, architecture and whatever. He's looking for spurs for his music from all kinds of directions, which is fine and valid, you know, but it's not just like, you know, looking at an audience and say, "What can I do for you? You know, I want to entertain you." On the other hand, like, he is doing this incredible work of, he's been doing these workshops for decades all over the place, all over the world. And he inculcates students, he teaches students in his methods and his ideas. And, you know, the students then go on to have careers of their own. I had this idea last night that it's like Steve Coleman is building an audience of musicians, one musician at a time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The same could be said, I mean, that's a flip thing to say, but the same thing could be said about Anthony Braxton, too. You know, he has reached so many musicians who are fascinated by his concepts, fascinated by this idea, this sort of web-like idea that he has.
Right.
And
you know, it's worth noting, too, that there was a rhetoric around it, certainly at the beginning, that I think was pretty self-consciously designed to present his music as part of a system. And I'm speaking of M-Bass,
yeah.
You know, which in the 80s, you know, at a time when anything like this was kind of an oppositional energy. He came out with MBASE and said, you know, this is sort of my coalition and my concept. And MBASE stood for Macro Basic Array of Structured Extemporization. And, you know, critics subsequently sort of grappled with it and saying, well, is it a style? Is it a school? Is it a language? You know, and the answer was kind of all of the above.
Yeah.
And, you know, out of this MBASE movement, you know, I don't think each of these people is 100% belonging to that system, but all of them took something from it. You know, there's Cassandra Wilson, Greg Osby, who then mentored Jason Moran, mm-hmm. Jerry Allen. So there's been a lot of traction with this thing. But I think when we talk about Steve Coleman as a kind of a fount of pedagogy and mentorship, it's significant that he made the decision to kind of start from this place of, here is an institution that I'm creating.
Right. I'm building an institution all by myself. It's like a guerrilla activity.
Yeah.
And we can think about it any way we want as, you know, a lot of obscure metaphysical talk or whatever. But the fact is that he helped create a sound. I mean, like, forget about all the literature. Forget about all the big words. He helped create a sound that is really recognizable. It's easy to hear in jazz these days. It's all over the place.
Right.
I think maybe part of this came from him working with Dave Holland, too, mm-hmm. during that time in the late 80s or it was the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that. You know, the bridge from Dave Holland circa, you know, Conference of the Birds, in which he's got Anthony Braxton on board, and then, you know, and Sam Rivers sort of coming out of that 70s AACM thing. And then, you know, Dave Holland kind of moves it forward, and then he's got Steve Coleman and Kevin Eubanks, you know, in this other band. You know, you really begin to think about these things as continuums, you know. I'd also be curious to hear your thoughts about what it means for him to access things like, you know, Yoruban, you know, Orishas, and, you know, rhythmic concepts from Brazil and Cuba, and, you know, just thinking about the ancient world in a super contemporary way.
Yeah.
How do you sort of see that?
I think he's doing something very honest and true, which is that he's looking back in order to go forward. Mm-hmm. You know, he's trying to find out what music means and what it has meant going way back in time. Music is not just entertainment. The further back you go in time, you know, it's something that actually has a purpose, like a real purpose. You know,
right.
It can heal people and
right.
It can establish community. It can bring people together. It's sort of a code for a ritual activity and all that stuff. He became interested in all that. And I think he also became interested in, just on a musical level, how he could use polyrhythms in Afro-Brazilian music and in Afro-Cuban music mm-hmm. and apply them to his work. Because, you know, rhythm's really important to him. Why wouldn't you explore that? I also think, and we can talk about this a little more in a minute, I wonder if it gave him a sense of, this can loosen me up. This can both expand my music and loosen it up.
Right, right.
But before we get to that, I want to just play a little bit from a more recent record than The Sign and the Seal, a track called Attila 04 from a record called Harvesting Semblances and Affinities from a few years ago. Okay, that's Attila 04 from a more recent Steve Coleman and Five Elements record. But the thing we came in on, Abakwa Obatala, was from 96. Some recordings that Steve Coleman did in Cuba involving Afro-Cuba de Matanzas and some Cuban percussionists. we're talking about what does that do for him? Why was he drawn to that? It's relevant to this conversation, especially because last night at the Stone, he had a setup something like that. He had his core group, Five Elements, plus two other people, the pianist David Bryant and the tenor saxophonist Maria Grand. But beyond that, he had five percussionists, three Cuban and two from Bahia, Brazil. Listening to that, it brought me back to the 90s when he was doing these experiments, recording in Cuba and stuff. And it did make me think about why did he do that in the first place? Why was that important to him? And, you know, all that crosstalk between all those percussionists in this little club last night,
yeah,
going on at the same time with all his complicated music, there was a density about it, like a real density, sort of like Electric Miles.
Yeah.
You know, Electric Miles, 1971. But there was also like a, in some weird way, it sort of cooled everything out and it increased the space in the music. And it sort of brought everything down to earth.
Because there's so many sources of rhythm in one ensemble, it has an effect of dispersing the pulse in a way, or having like a double or triple exposure. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Instead of like one rigid pulse that you're supposed to respond to, it's kind of like it's a swarm, or it's like this three-dimensional field.
What's so interesting in his music that people play lots of short notes, you know? There's lots of, it's like layer upon layer upon layer of people playing all these very short and pointed notes. And so that's why there's tons going on in it, but there's space in it. And for some reason, all the sort of the combination of the percussionists weaving among each other and working together in coordination somehow increases that feeling of you're hearing a lot of stuff, but there's a lot of space in it. And everyone is being heard. People aren't playing big, sloppy, messy tones that blot out the rest of the ensemble. You can actually hear everything. And for somebody who seems to have this interest in, you know, multiplicity, one thing leads to another, everything is connected to everything else, that makes an awful lot of sense.
Yeah. It's an extremely disciplined kind of music for all of this sort of experimental energies in it. I feel like discipline is a word that often comes to mind with him.
That's right. It's quite amazing what he's been able to do, and with such a lot of energy, too. Most jazz musicians are sort of represented to the world through the records they make. But this is a guy who also goes around doing workshops all the time.
Right.
And actually does sort of one-to-one meetings. And in fact, in the band last night, I mean, you could see the result of that. You know, half the band was made up of people who used to be his students or kept showing up at workshops and then eventually joined the group. You mentioned Charlie Parker and the fact that here's a guy who doesn't just come out of nowhere. Steve Coleman is yet another musician who, as far as I know, doesn't really like the word jazz, feels that it's too limiting. But he cares a lot about Charlie Parker. He cares a lot about John Coltrane. He's from Chicago, and Von Freeman and Bunky Green and a lot of elders in Chicago were important to him. When you hear him play, as I did last night, you often hear him play little snippets of Charlie Parker songs or solos, like actual complete sections of Charlie Parker solos.
It's all part of the brain cloud.
Yeah. One of the last things he did in the concert last night as an ending place was to play the Charlie Parker's improvised introduction to Coco. I wanted to end this podcast with Steve Coleman playing a Charlie Parker song, Alucha, from a live record called Resistance is Futile, recorded, I think, sometime around 2000 or early 2000s. This is including Ambrose Eck and Musery, who you were talking about earlier, Nate, and also Jonathan Finlayson, the trumpeter, who's still in the band, is there at the Stone this week. But at the time of this record, I think was maybe 18 or so. So we'll hear Steve Coleman and Five Elements playing Charlie Parker's A Lucha. And Nate, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
That's our show. Thank you for listening. You can read what I have to say about Steve Coleman and his performance at The Stone at nytimes.com/music. Steve Coleman and Five Elements with various people, including, as I understand it, a string quartet and maybe different rhythm section players, will continue through Sunday at The Stone in the East Village, East 2nd Street and Avenue C, thestonenyc.com. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. And thank you for listening.